I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a new online sports management master's degree. Learn business skills for today's fast-paced sports environment. Details are available at uwp.edu. Two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Larry Olmsted. I spoke with him about his book, Getting Into Guinness, a fascinating exploration of the Guinness Book of World Records. We also talked about his book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. But today, we talk about a very different book, a book called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. In this very, very intriguing book, Larry Olmsted explores some of the different ways in which we benefit from following sports and being devoted to sports, including some ways that may be relatively simple and obvious and other ways that perhaps entirely escape our notice. And it's a wonderful, intriguing, illuminating book that I've enjoyed very much reading. Larry Olmsted, by the way, in addition to being a highly regarded journalist, has also taught at Dartmouth College, teaching nonfiction writing. And, of course, he knows an awful lot about that. This new book published by Algonquin is called, again, Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. Larry Olmsted, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Oh, thanks so much, Greg, but you're making me feel a little bit old going all the way back to Guinness.
Right. But, man, I really loved that book and enjoyed speaking with you about it, and I'm excited about this conversation as well because I've really enjoyed this book. And I should say, I am not what most people would think of as a rabid sports fan. I do follow tennis, play it a bit. I do follow figure skating, and I follow the Green Bay Packers and the Chicago Cubs to some extent, but I'm not a capital F sports fan the way some people are, and yet I just found this book endlessly fascinating, and I think all of our listeners, to whatever degree they care about sports or not, I think will be really intrigued by the premise. Let's start with you. What kind of a sports fan are you, and did you come to this question about sports fandom as a rabid sports fan yourself?
Definitely not rabid. I would say, you know, like you described yourself, and I hear this from a lot of people, you know, I'm not that much of a sports fan. I only follow four or five different sports. You know, I primarily, you know, grew up following baseball, and now, you know, the NFL is my preferred favorite sport, but I certainly, you know, don't sit around watching, you know, college basketball and things. I have nothing against it, but, you know, to me, a rabid sports fan is multi-sport, a lot more consumption of sport than I do. What I am now is a rabid fan of sports fans because I've learned so much about them. And, you know, when I came to this from the opposite perspective, in that I went to a game at Fenway Park, Red Sox game years ago, and saw this couple with two young kids who had dressed their young kids in shirts with custom-made T-shirts with obscenities on them directed at the New York Yankees. And I remember thinking, like, you know, what's wrong with these people? You know, these kids are like 5, 7 years old. They don't even know, you know, what this means. But, you know, why would you do this? And after the game, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And finally, I said, you know, maybe there's something about being sports fans that makes us crazy, turns us into bad people. Maybe there's a book there. And I started doing research and quickly saw the data was completely the opposite. And the reason why those people stood out to me, I didn't notice the other 50,000 people, is because most sports fans are, you know, nice, well-adjusted, normal people. They're your neighbors, and, you know, there's bad apples in every bunch, and they stood out so much because they were the rarity. But, you know, when I started diving into data, I said, wow, this is, you know, kind of an untold story, how beneficial fandom can be.
Mm. Let's talk through a few of the things that you explore, and even the things you explore that, in a sense, are so obvious that perhaps they could even go without saying. I'm glad you go ahead and say them and explore them just a little bit. You know, on the most basic level, we watch sports to be entertained. But one of the things you tell us is that there is something about sports that makes it very different from many other, maybe just about all other kinds of entertainment, and namely, it is the unscripted nature of sports. Tell us more about that, about why that's a crucial element that so many of us so often overlook.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one, a lot of people say, oh, you know, well, I'm a fan of whatever, Harry Potter. Isn't that, you know, do you get the same benefits? And the only form of entertainment I found that I think is truly comparable to sports is being a deadhead, and you can't see the Grateful Dead anymore, so that's off the table. It is the unscripted nature. It's completely unpredictable. And when you go to see Star Wars, you know, even if it takes 9 movies and 30 years, that, you know, the good guys are going to win. And, you know, or you go to see James Bond movie, he's not going to let the bad guy blow up the world. Most entertainment is sort of preordained, but, you know, sports, anything can happen, which is why we feel compelled to watch it in real time, and nobody waits to the end of the season and then binges 17 episodes of the NFL the way they would, you know, Breaking Bad or something. But also, I mean, there's a lot of key differentiators, and you know, the key happiness of being a sports fan is a sense of belonging to a community, and that's why we call it Nation, you know, Red Sox Nation, Packers Nation, Jets Nation, whatever it is. And when you watch it on TV and you see 30 or 40 or 50,000 people there in the stands dressed in uniforms, you feel as if you're at the game. And that doesn't happen when you watch a movie or a sitcom. You don't see the audience. You're not part of the audience. And when you go to the supermarket and you see people and I walk by and they're wearing a Packers hat and you're wearing a Packers hat and you give a little nod and you're part of, you know, this Packers community, even though you're strangers. And that could happen, you know, with music or other forms of entertainment, but the chances of you both being wearing like Metallica baseball caps is pretty slim compared to Packers, especially in Milwaukee.
Yeah. Another point you make early in the book that I also think is fairly obvious, and yet we really don't stop to think about this, is how pervasive athletic endeavor has been through nearly all of human history, which is really an interesting thing to think about, that humankind for such a long time has been enamored with athletic competition to one degree or another. I mean, it is sort of woven into so much of our history, and it doesn't matter where you are on the globe.
No, that's true. And I mean, you know, you think of it, you can't think about, say, ancient Greece without immediately thinking about the Olympics. But, you know, even further than that, you know, I've gone down to the Yucatan Peninsula and visited some of the ruins down there, you know, the old lost pyramids and the cities, Coba and Chichen Itza. And, you know, they all have these engravings of them playing these games that, you know, sort of similar to basketball, engraved on the side of these pyramids. And when you look at around the world, they're the traditional sports, whether it's like Scottish Highland Games or you know, in Tibet, every culture has these traditional games that go back forever. And that was at a time when, you know, we didn't have the amount of leisure time we had now. You know, you had to chop firewood and hunt and things to stay alive, yet they still found that athletic endeavors were important enough to make time for.
Right. And so it really then begs the question of why is this so important to so many of us, and why has it been so important for such a long time? And, of course, part of your book is to explore some of the benefits of engaging in sports, of following sports, of caring about sports. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Larry Olmsted, best-selling author of several previous books, and most recently a book called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. You have a couple of different chapters in the book that are called something, Sports and Our Brains, in which you really sort of turn on its head the superstition that or the stereotype that many of us have about the typical sports fan being somebody who's maybe not especially well-read, not especially intelligent, but just likes to watch a good football game and maybe crunch a beer can against their forehead. I mean, we've all seen that stereotype, and most of us are probably guilty of embracing that stereotype from time to time. In this part of the book, you really suggest something very different, that in fact, when somebody passionately follows a given sport, that we are engaging on a cognitive level that is really, in some ways, quite impressive and also quite beneficial to us. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've come increasingly to think of following sports as similar to, you know, doing Sudoku or crossword puzzles. I mean, you know, scientists know that exercising your brain is good for you, especially as you get older. And, you know, being an avid sports fan is an intellectual exercise. And increasingly so today. I mean, when I grew up, you know, following baseball, you know, we knew about ERA and RBIs and batting average, but, you know, then Moneyball comes along and sabermetrics, and suddenly there's all of these new statistics that, you know, you can't hardly pronounce, let alone understand. And every sport, the NBA, the NFL, the defenses, the formations have gotten much more complex. You know, I was just, you know, watching this Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance, and you see them diagramming the plays, and, you know, like, wow, I didn't realize that much went into, you know, planning a basketball play. But, you know, the fans of each sport do understand that, and especially when, you know, now when they call in to talk radio the next day to second-guess the coaches, well, in order to do that, you have to have an understanding of everything that's going on, and that is really an intellectual enterprise.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us, even if we engage in this, if we can rattle off the Wimbledon singles winners from the 1970s, we don't sort of stop to think about what a remarkable thing that is when we wrap our brains around the things that we really care about and engage with sport on that level. We are doing ourselves sort of an intellectual and cognitive favor of sorts.
Yeah, and one of the things is, you know, I mean, most teams don't win. You know, a lot of people associate the happiness of being a sports fan with winning and losing, but it's definitely not that simple. I mean, only one team's going to win the Super Bowl. Only one team's going to win the World Series. And that would lead you to believe that, you know, 95% of the team's fans were unhappy. But the reality is, when you do win, you know, I remember when the Nets won the World Series in 1986, and I remember the players on the team. I don't remember so much about, like, the 1992 nebulous season, but when you talk to older fans, they always remember that winning year and what happened and what the record was. So you don't need to imprint every game in your memory for it to make a difference. It's, you know, a few is enough.
I want to talk about another interesting part of your book that explores the way in which organized team sports have played a role when perhaps our entire nation or given communities have suffered some kind of trauma. And it sometimes has been sports that has, in a sense, led the community or led our nation back to some sense of healthy normalcy. I didn't expect this in the book when I came across this chapter. It really kind of threw me for a loop and really hit me hard. And I'm so glad that this really serious, thoughtful discussion is part of your book. And part of what you talk about is 9/11 and an extraordinary temporary exhibition that you saw at the 9/11 Museum. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you were surprised and moved, because this is my favorite part of the book, and it was the most surprising to me in the research. You know, I knew about 9/11. I once worked in the World Trade Center. You know, I grew up in New York, but I didn't realize, you know, that this was a recurring trend that happened all around the world throughout history after natural and man-made disasters. But in that case, you know, they ran a special exhibition at the museum called Sport After 9/11, and it was all about the use of spectator sport to heal our community, our national fabric. And it wasn't just 9/11, you know, and it was a lot about it. And I remember, you know, all major sports, every professional sport in the country stopped after 9/11 and came back about, I don't know, 9 or 10 days later. And the first game played in New York after 9/11 was a Mets Brave game, a baseball game at Shea, which the Mets won on this sort of come-from-behind Cinderella home run by Mike Piazza, and he was wearing a helmet that he had handwritten the New York Fire Department logo on. And it's just become an iconic part of baseball history. And, in fact, Major League Baseball scheduled a Mets-Yankees game for 9/11 this year because it's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And that's going to be a really big deal come this fall. You're going to be hearing a lot about that. But, you know, I was talking to the curator, and he's from New Orleans, and he said, yeah, you know, the same thing with the Saints after Hurricane Katrina, and same thing with the Red Sox after the Boston Marathon bombing. And, you know, I came to appreciate how big a role sports plays in healing. One of the Mets fans told me that, you know, that game, they said, you know, that was the moment when it was okay to smile again, to clap, you know, to be normal after this trauma. And most recently, this one October horrific mass shooting in Las Vegas in 2017 came right before the first season of the Golden Knights, their NHL team. And Las Vegas was the biggest city in the country that didn't have a professional sports team in any of the major sports. They get this hockey team, and it starts 9 days after the worst mass shooting in American history. So I went out there, and I interviewed people who had been shot, who had been shot at, who were traumatized about, you know, the role the Knights played in their recovery. And when I hear these stories, I could no longer dismiss sport as anything frivolous or mere entertainment. It's, you know, it's a part of our, a vibrant part of our lives and our social fabric.
One of the people you quote in the book is a history professor at the University of North Carolina, Matthew Andrews, who also seems to be very, very interested in sports. And when you talk with him about this, he makes a point that I think is so interesting. He says sports has absolutely played this role, this kind of healing role. And it's because these are really important places where people can just be emotional and talk about feelings. After September 11th, baseball stadiums seemed to be places where people could talk about healing and coming together. And I had never stopped to think about that, how, I mean, because in some ways it's unlikely. I mean, it's not exactly a therapist's office or the meditation chapel at one's church, but it is a place where, in a sense, feelings run high and where there is a sense of kind of emotional openness, where probably one could engage in surprisingly deep and meaningful conversations with complete strangers because they don't feel like complete strangers. They are fellow Yankees fans or Packers fans or whatever.
And the sheer scope of it, I mean, our stadiums are our largest public gathering places. They're bigger. The biggest stadiums are bigger than the biggest churches or synagogues or mosques. There's, you know, there's no place you can put more people in one spot than, you know, the big house at the University of Michigan. And, you know, I mean, football stadiums, baseball stadiums, you know, and typically after some kind of a traumatic event, people stay home for some period of time, and then when they're ready, they want to go out. I mean, right now is a perfect example. I mean, sports is going to have a healing normalcy power again post-vaccination, post-pandemic. To me, when you can go sit shoulder to shoulder with 50,000 strangers and high-five them without worry about, you know, getting sick and dying from it, that's when, you know, we've turned the corner. And you know, I look forward to being able to do that.
We're speaking with Larry Olmsted about his book, Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. I guess because I recently interviewed another author about a book concerning the great Jackie Robinson, I read with exceptional interest the portion of your book in which you talk about how the arena of sports has been an arena in which certain really important advancements have been made in the realm of civil rights, and for that matter, women's rights as well. And of course, it goes beyond just a trailblazer like Jackie Robinson. What did you find out as you sort of explored this aspect of sports fandom when it comes to a matter like civil rights?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly we don't yet, unfortunately, live in a perfect world, and we still have a lot of issues with systemic racism and inequality. But there's no doubt to me that sports fandom has played a big role in what progress we have made. And Jackie Robinson is clearly the highest profile example because, you know, he was such a – I mean, baseball was by far the biggest sport at that time, truly was, you know, America's sport, bigger than football is now. And so there was no bigger national stage on which you could have a barrier broken like that. And, you know, when Ken Burns, the famous documentary filmmaker, you know, did a documentary about Jackie Robinson, and he said that, you know, without Jackie Robinson, you could not have President Obama elected. I thought, well, you know, maybe that's a little bit extreme, except then I saw that Obama said the same thing. So, you know, it definitely was a big step, but there have been a lot of other steps, and what interested me was, well, you know, how does this process actually work? And, you know, I talked to psychologists about it, and it turns out that, you know, sports fans internalize their relationship with the team so much that it literally becomes a part of them. And then your choice, if the team does something, you know, if you're a Brooklyn Dodgers fan at the time and you're racist, which a lot of people were, you have a choice. You can either, you know, kind of disavow the Dodgers, or you can accept the change and move on. And because the Dodgers are now a part of you, it's a lot easier to just accept the change and move on than it is, you know, quitting the Dodgers would be akin to, you know, giving up your religion, which some people do, but not many. And so that is how, you know, sports teams and leagues maybe sometimes make decisions that don't sit well with the fans, but the fans come to accept them. And usually that is a road to progress. And right now, you know, we're going through this time in the social justice movement, really a watershed moment. There have always been activist athletes, but the teams and the leagues have had a long tradition of trying to sort of stay out of it with their heads in the sand, and suddenly the teams and the leagues are taking a role. And that's a very new thing, and I think that's sort of the next great change for sports fandom.
Interesting. And I like the way you phrased that when you said, you know, for instance, the Dodgers taking on Jackie Robinson and the fans in the stands who were racists coming to accept that to some degree. I'm sure some of them never did, but many of them, of course, came to some extent accept Jackie Robinson. It's not that in and of itself ended their own racism, but it was a step in that direction, and probably a very healthy step, and probably a step that they at the time weren't even fully aware of.
Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, a subconscious thing, a slight increase in tolerance. But there's been a lot of studies over the years of how diversity in sports actually, you know, affects our tolerance. And that's why, you know, in the title of my book, Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding, and that's the understanding part, that sports fandom actually makes us, you know, more open-minded, more democratic-minded, more tolerant people. And that's why I think, you know, I kind of, you know, obviously sports fans are going to find a lot that they like in my book, but I'm hoping non-fans read it because I'd like them to see how the world is a better place and they benefit from sports fandom in these ways of living in a better world, even if they never watch a game.
I think a little less obvious is the connection between sports fandom and the issue of women's rights. In what way do you see sports fandom as having played a significant role in that respect?
Well, you had the same, you know, high-profile kind of activist players like Billie Jean King championing equal pay in sports, you know, which mirrors a much bigger pay inequality issue in, you know, the rest of our society, in corporate America, and all kinds of jobs, and really, you know, publicly fighting for that. But the biggest thing was probably, you know, Title IX, in terms of making, you know, the colleges have equality of teams, which, you know, led to a lot of more high-profile women's sports success, especially, you know, soccer and at the Olympic level. And in turn, you know, a lot of former athletes, you know, who have become successful CEOs or leaders otherwise, you know, credit that with, you know, they never would have had these opportunities. Playing sports certainly can help you be successful in other fields, and, you know, a lot of that came out of Title IX.
Right. We should say that your book does not ignore the fact that there are those bad apples, as you termed them at one point, that can spoil this to some extent, and sports fans are guilty to some extent of overlooking bad behavior when it is an athlete that they really, really love or is really, really instrumental in their favorite team's success. How do you want us to kind of fold this unhappy reality into what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, fans have a lot of power, more power than I think they sometimes realize over sports. I mean, really, you know, there's no spectator sports without spectators, and the reason why athletes make so much money is because there are spectators, and they can sell commercials, and they can sell advertising. And, you know, for example, you know, the NFL had this concussion issue, and it's gone on for a long time, and they had lawsuits, and there was a movie about it, and it's not like nobody knew that there was a concussion problem, but it wasn't until fans started to turn away from the product and ratings went down that suddenly, you know, they had to do something about it, and that's, you know, fans have that power. So when, you know, there's somebody on your team who does wrong, you know, you can stop watching and then, you know, tell management, you know, hey, we don't want whatever it is, a child molester, a drunk driver who killed someone, you know, representing our team. But a lot of fans say, well, you know, that person's a really good player and they help us win, so we'll excuse that. And I think, you know, that it's a moral decision you sometimes have to make, that being, you know, a good athlete is not enough to make up for certain bad behavior. And, you know, it's not like all athletes, you know, are poor role models. A lot of them are great role models. It's any population, fans, athletes, you know, of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands or millions of people, you know, if you have, you know, 1% or 0.5% or whatever the number is of bad apples, that's still going to be, you know, a significant number. When you go to the stadium, there's 50,000 people. If 1% of them, you know, are you know, yelling obscenities and drunk, that's still going to be a couple hundred people who are going to, you know, spoil some other people's experience.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It ends up being an arena in which we wrestle with some of these sociological issues and ethical dilemmas and so on. That is part of the mix when one is devoted to a team and to its athletes, some of whom are very much imperfect. Early in the book, you cite some very impressive statistics that apparently stem from studies done of college graduates, that those college students who were sports fans could boast of higher GPAs, higher graduation rate, a higher income levels once they had graduated from college. Have enough studies been done to help us determine what the real correlation is there? I mean, is it just that smart people like sports, or is it that liking sports makes you smart? I mean, how much further do we have to go in order to really understand what that connection in fact is?
Yeah, I would say there is not enough data in that particular area, but where and some of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I would say, you know, what it indicated to me most strongly is the GPA part is sort of the first step, right? If you do better in school, the other things follow. You're more likely to graduate. You're more likely to get a better job. The reason that you do better, I think, is because of this sense of community and belonging. And, you know, the mental health benefits that they've established for avid sports fans include things like higher self-esteem, better social connectivity. So for most people, going off to college is a change. It's stressful. It's, you know, a new set of friends, a new set of challenges, maybe your first time away from home. So people who have higher self-esteem, better social connectivity, are going to be happier and do better, and happier people, more adjusted people, are going to, in most cases, get better grades. All the other success sort of stems from there. So I think it's the success in college part that's most attributable to being a sports fan, not necessarily, you know, the higher income later.
Mm. A very touching moment of your book is when you explore the phenomenon of Make-A-Wish, and how in many, many cases a youngster battling a life-threatening illness or disease, their wish will have something to do with their favorite sports team. And you cite some really touching examples of how this has played out. Do you have a favorite you want to share with our listeners?
Well, I mean, to me, you know, I didn't realize, you know, sort of sadly, I didn't realize how many people, you know, survive the Make-A-Wish process. I thought of it as something for, you know, kids who are going to die. And but a lot of them don't. And when I got to speak to adults who had gone through this as a child, that was, you know, and it basically changed their lives. That was, one of the people that I interviewed as an adult, he was so moved, such a sports fan, and so moved by his Make-A-Wish experience that he went into professional sports management and worked for the Yankees and some other teams. And that really, you know, kind of came full circle for me.
Mm. To finish out on a lighter note, I think the most amusing section of the book is when, in the second chapter about sports and our brains, when you explore some of the amazing superstitions that many sports fans have, and some of these are pretty amazing.
That's something I debated and not even putting in, because it doesn't really, you know, add to the data, but it was so entertaining I couldn't leave it out. One hockey fan who puts his socks in the freezer to get them to the same temperature as the pucks on the ice. The way, you know, the things people eat and these routines. This one fan who, you know, would go get a hot dog at only one line and then eat three quarters of it, wrap it up, go get popcorn, eat half of it, had, you know, and every game, this ritualistic system. And then they changed the stadium and they had to come up with a new one. But my favorite of all those people was one woman who refused to be interviewed about it, because she said that if she shared her lucky superstitions, they would no longer help her team win.
Yes. Well, I guess it underscores the fact that even if being a sports fan makes us smarter, it doesn't keep us from being superstitious. But at any rate, I think your book makes a very persuasive case for how sports fandom can very much enrich not only our lives, but our world, for that matter. Although I want to hasten to add that your book does engage with some of the aspects of sports fandom that sometimes verge on the extreme, or that can lead to darker realities. But by and by, sports fandom has been, in your mind, a very, very positive force in our world and in our lives. And I think you spell that out very convincingly in your book, Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding, published by Algonquin Books. The author, Larry Olmsted. Larry Olmsted, what a great pleasure to reconnect with you. Thank you for giving the world this really interesting and fun book, and best wishes.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to let you hear from a guest that I spoke to on yesterday's morning show, acclaimed biographer J. Randy Taraborelli. Yesterday, we talked about his most recent book, Grace and Steel, which examines the lives and experiences of some of the extraordinary women who are part of the Bush dynasty, including Dorothy, Barbara, and Laura Bush. Today, you'll hear my conversation from back in 2012 when I talked with Mr. Taraborelli about one of his books concerning the Kennedy family. Some of you may remember from several years ago a conversation I was pleased to have with J. Randy Taraborelli, a very gifted biographer who's written well-known biographies of Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, and on the occasion of our conversation on the morning show, a very good book, a very discerning look at Elizabeth Taylor. Mr. Taraborelli has written extensively about the Kennedy family as well, probably most notably in a book called Jackie Ethel Joan, Women of Camelot. And the newest book from J. Randy Taraborelli is, in effect, a sequel to that, chronicling 44 years of the entire Kennedy clan and much of what has occurred to them, including, in the author's words, no shortage of catastrophic misfortune. The book is After Camelot, A Personal History of the Kennedy Family, 1968 to the present. J. Randy Taraborelli, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's great to be back. How are you?
I'm fine. As I look over the table of contents, I'm just dumbstruck by how much you are covering in this book. I mean, when we see headings like Jackie or Sarge or Ted or Ethel or chapter headings that refer to other notable occasions in this sprawling saga, we realize to put all of this into a single book has to be an overwhelming challenge for you as the author, and yet you obviously saw a point in not zeroing in on specifics as much as looking at all of this as one grand story. Tell us what the grand canvas, in fact, is, why it was worth undertaking such a monumental story in a single book.
Well, you know, it definitely, as you pointed out, you know, this is a story that's about a lot more than just, you know, iconic legends and their moment on the national stage. I approached this as a family drama. These were, in many ways, everyday people in extraordinary circumstances, you know, where all of their gifts or flaws and their successes and failures were magnified by public scrutiny. So in the end, what I tried to accomplish with After Camelot is to return the human face to this legendary political family and truly bring the reader closer to the universal drama that all of us at one time or another have shared with the Kennedys, because, you know, we've always been able to relate to the Kennedys. They're accessible public heroes in a way that many celebrity figures aren't. They're real to us. I mean, we've all suffered joy and loss, and we've all had our moments of triumph and defeat, and so have they. And so I wanted my readers to sort of go on this journey and get to know all the characters, including people who married into the family that my readers might not be familiar with, such as Sergeant Shriver and Eunice Kennedy Shriver, two amazing people in our culture. You know, Sergeant Shriver, who co-founded the Peace Corps with President Kennedy. Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who created the Special Olympics, which has done so much for so many people. And those are people that I also wanted to write about. So this is a very in-depth, pretty comprehensive look at the Kennedys.
I mean, it's not easy to achieve depth and breadth to the extent that you have in this book. Of course, the Kennedys are, as you say, on one level a very public family, and yet a family that also seeks to insulate itself from certain kinds of intrusion. To what extent did you have any kind of cooperation from the family, or otherwise, how were you able to sort of get at the heart of the story without their cooperation?
Well, you know, what I did was I over the course of my lifetime, I've interviewed many Kennedys. You know, I interviewed John Kennedy Jr., I interviewed Eunice Kennedy, you know, I talked to Sergeant Shriver, Ted Kennedy. you know, if you've been around long enough, you've been a reporter long enough, luckily, these people end up in, you know, in your experience. I met Jackie Kennedy when I was a writer at Doubleday, and she was an editor, and I wrote about all those experiences in this book as well. But I'll tell you what also came in handy for me were the thousands and thousands of pages of oral histories that are deposited at the JFK Library in Boston, and they're available to any researcher who has the time and inclination to sit there for months and months at a time and read this stuff, because there's a lot of valuable stuff there. And also the LBJ Library has an amazing treasure trove as well, and I was able to listen to tape recorded conversations between Jackie Kennedy and President Lyndon Johnson, for instance. So fascinating to hear their voices and to hear the way that Jackie Kennedy and LBJ related to one another. And I used a lot of that in the book as well. So the book is really sort of the compilation of a lot of research experiences for me.
Well, and I remember hearing you say in an interview that this book, in a sense, was 20 years in the making. I mean, a book of this dimension and scale does not get put together in a day.
No, I've always had this on the back burner. You know, whenever I was working on a project, I would always try to figure out which of these sources are going to be interesting in this Kennedy book. When I wrote Marilyn Monroe, for instance, you know, which of the sources in the Marilyn Monroe story can I refer to when I finally write After Camelot, when I wrote Frank Sinatra? I mean, all these people have had lives that have dovetailed at one time or another, and the sources are the same in many instances, and then they know other people who knew other people. And luckily, you know, after 17 books, you know, I've been around long enough to be able to make those calls, you know, that you need to make in order to get the information that you need to have for a book like this.
We should touch on a couple of things that are especially interesting. For instance, for as fascinating as the marriage of Jackie Kennedy was to John Kennedy, in some respects even more fascinating or intriguing, let's say, is her second marriage, which of course was to one of the wealthiest men in the world, Aristotle Onassis. I know that you are especially proud of the fact that in this book you are able to share with the public information never known before on what essentially sorts of amounts to a brokered agreement between the Kennedy family and Mr. Onassis before Onassis' marriage to Jacqueline took place.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me, you know, that Aristotle Onassis was somebody who really believed in Greek tradition, and an ancient Greek tradition was that the husband would give the wife money upon the marriage. It was sort of a dowry in reverse. And Onassis made the offer to give Jackie $1.5 million when they married. And true to the way these things are in these kinds of big political families, it ended up a negotiation. Ted Kennedy went and tried to negotiate more money for Jackie, and he ended up getting her $3 million. And then it went to Jackie's business manager, and he tried to get $20 million. You know, but ultimately, Onassis settled at $3 million, and that's how much Jackie received upon marrying him. I don't want this to suggest that they didn't love each other, because I believe that they did. It does, though, sort of beg the question of, you know, the kinds of world that these people lived in, where these kinds of transactions were not looked at as being unusual. That this was not anything that anybody thought was strange. It was just the way it was, and that kind of fascinated me.
Sure, and evidently something with which they were both, at least to some extent, comfortable. It was their reality, as strange as it might seem to
us. Yeah,
I
mean, as I like to say, you know, Jackie Kennedy wasn't the kind of woman who would ask for the money, but she also wasn't the kind of woman who would turn it down.
And, of course, you chart through this book Jacqueline Kennedy's fascinating story. Once Mr. Onassis has died and she builds for herself a very fulfilling professional life, and then, of course, the story eventually of her physical decline and death. Another really interesting story in this book, exceptionally interesting, is that of Sergeant Shriver. And you, among other things, describe what seemed to some, including Mr. Shriver himself, as sort of a glass ceiling that existed that in which the family looked at someone like Sergeant Shriver, who married into the family, looked at him differently than someone who was a Kennedy by birthright. And I wonder if you can help us untangle the question of how much of that was real. I mean, is that just the way Sergeant Shriver felt? Or, in fact, were those kind of attitudes, in fact, really held by most of the Kennedy family?
Well, there was a culture in the family that protected a certain lineage and pecking order to the White House. No one outside of the Kennedy brothers was going to interfere with that sort of predetermined line of succession. It was going to be Jack, and then Bobby, and then it was going to be Ted. And until it was Ted, no one else would have a shot at the presidency. So there was a lot that Sergeant Shriver could have done for this country, but his presidential aspirations could never be realized because he wasn't Ted Kennedy. And it wasn't something that he imagined. It was definitely in play all the time. And as I pointed out in the book, and I really wrote about this in depth in the book because it's not been written about, and I think it deserves to be written about because Sergeant Shriver is such a great American and such a patriot. That it's a shame many people believe still today, you know, that he just really was not able to achieve what he wanted to achieve because he never had this full and unconditional support of the Kennedy family in his political aspirations. That's the truth. I mean, he just never did. And you can imagine what kind of position this put Eunice Kennedy in, his wife, who was more Kennedy than most Kennedys. You know, but when it came down to this issue, as to where her support, where her loyalty was going to go, it always went to her husband. She always believed that her husband was a great man who should have had more support from the family and his political aspirations. But man, until Ted Kennedy became president, which never happened, but until that was going to happen, there was just not going to be room for Sergeant in the Kennedy's view of the presidency. And you know, sir, I met Sergeant Shriver, such an amazing man. I mean, he's a personal hero of mine. And he just never really took this personally. You know, he was the kind of guy who said, you know, you can't let this get to you. You cannot take politics personally, or else it will just eat you up alive. And that's how he lived his life. You know, he was a very religious man. He was competitive. He was ambitious. He was political. He was all of those things, but he was also the kind of person who wanted to raise his family separate and apart from the Kennedy ambition. And a good story in my book is when Bobby Kennedy, his son, was a little boy and he was injured in a sporting accident and he wanted to cry. And Bobby said, you know, I want to cry, Dad, but I can't because Kennedys don't cry. And Sergeant Shriver said, you can cry because you're not a Kennedy, you're a Shriver. Just thought that was such an interesting story. And that's the kind of man Sergeant Shriver was.
And, of course, it's an amazing story filled with triumph and, of course, so much tragedy piled on top as well. The book is After Camelot, A Personal History of the Kennedy Family, 1968 to the present. 44 years of this family's amazing life. J. Randy Tarabarelli, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about your very interesting book. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it very much.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a new online sports management master's degree. Learn business skills for today's fast